If you're in eyeshot of an outline, it might help you. So if some of you might be willing to share, I didn't bring enough. I'm sorry for that. We're using two outlines today, and we're going to go back and forth. But these are handouts we use with clients in our clinic, and I thought I would put them both together today. Let's go ahead and begin the tape. This is a session on recovering from the obsessive pleasing of others. And my name is Jim Lundy. I want to do it very much again in discussion format and include you in this topic. This is probably the hottest topic in American psychology today because it's about recovery. It's about losing ourselves into other selves and the problem that happened, especially since World War II, of American children having trouble forming their own self-identity, and then that blossoms in our adulthood as we find ourselves, parents, educators, pastors, in whatever role, unsure about who we are. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. I didn't bring any particular books because the bookstore has a section on recovery, and it has several wonderful books on inner child dynamics and inner child work. So if you're interested in more of the details that go with this topic, you might want to visit the bookstore. Let me start by just talking about what the title means to me. Recovering from the obsessive pleasing of others. For me, obsessive behavior, doing something out of compulsion or a have-to or a repetition, means that the behavior doesn't flow freely from my own self, but rather it's some kind of an adaptation or a defense against another feeling or a problem. And so I could share a lot from my background, but I won't do that because I want your backgrounds in the discussion today. But let me just start with myself. I grew up in a very conservative Quaker environment where getting it right was utterly important. That was absolutely the most important thing you could do, was get the right words and the right principles. And I can remember very easily in first grade knowing arguments against evolution and for creation, knowing how to calculate a tithe and making sure that every birthday gift was properly tithed, and how to pursue those rules. And that became an obsession as a defense against the anxiety of maybe being disapproved of. I mean, what if you only gave 8% and somebody found out? It wasn't so much that God might get you, but that you would displease someone, and then you'd have to tolerate the anxiety of not being approved. And so obsessive behavior is often a defense against emotions that we don't want to experience, like depression, anxiety, rejection. And so we can determine within ourselves that we're going to walk up to a person or a group and say we've changed our mind. But what happens when you see the whites of their eyes? Well, your heart begins to beat. You begin to realize if you say no or you've changed your mind, you're going to experience an emotion that you're not prepared for, and right away you change your mind back and go along with the program, and you walk out of the room wondering why you signed up again to do that when you had vowed you weren't going to do that. Well, in part it's because of this obsessive behavior, this defense, this need to please others. And the important implication of the word others in the title is that we've lost ourselves. Now, we're not talking about selfishness. We're not talking about me-ism, I-ism. We're not talking about yuppie-ism. We're not talking about a new way in the name of psychology to Christianize taking from other people. We're talking about the formation of a self. And only out of a self can we really give. And I think Jesus was very clear about that, that he gave because he chose to give. It wasn't taken from him. Many of us give out of neurotic need or personal insecurity or anxiety. We don't give out of a fully formed self. So when we talk about recovering our lost selves, we're not doing that at the expense of someone. We're actually doing that in preparation to have riches to give. And I think a recovered self, a self, is a very rich thing. And it's out of that self that we can give. Let's turn then to the handout called "What Is an Adult Child? How to Deal with the Child? How to Heal the Child Within You," subtitled. And this little subtitle can just be a checklist for you. Just think back, and some of you had, you know, wonderful experiences in your early life, which have translated into all kinds of confidence and riches into your adult life. Others didn't. Use these four little words as a checklist. The right to recognize, have, and act on your own thoughts, feelings, wants, and desires. And let's just take a moment and stop here and get some feedback. If someone might want to share a childhood or a life experience where you had the opportunity to have your own thoughts, feelings, wants, and desires, or a childhood or an early learning experience where you were not given the right to have those things. Just take a minute. Anybody want to share the good or the bad side of that?
Mm-hmm. I want to share. I grew up in a pastor's family, and I grew up thinking that a feeling of anger was not appropriate. You know, in a small town, you know, small town Midwest, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the things that that feeling was not okay.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what you were supposed to have in place of it, or what happened to it?
Oh, always nice, no matter how boring we were.
Mm-hmm.
Or just deny it and run away. Mm-hmm. You know, try to
mm-hmm. Okay. Anybody else want
to? I was raised in a Southern conservative Baptist home, and it seems to me, as I remember it, that the main thrust of teaching in my family was what we're talking about today, that to please others was probably the most important and the thing that got you the most good response from other people.
Mm-hmm. And it did, didn't it?
Yeah, it worked.
Mm-hmm. And we want to be clear about that. In fairly functional homes, pleasing others got you a lot. It may have cost you your own special creativity. We don't want to run past it too fast, like, oh, it's all good. But it got you a lot of rewards, a lot of social acceptance. It cost you maybe your uniqueness, your creativity, your spontaneity.
A lot of guilt.
Mm-hmm. Creates guilt.
Mm-hmm. I had similar background. Pastor's home where, you know, you shouldn't feel that way. Any negative feelings were not to be dealt with. And the appearance of the family was very important. You know, to me. And I found it very difficult to realize that that was dysfunction, because that, you know, there wasn't anybody drunk, and there wasn't anything major to tell me that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't find out anything to make me happy other than outside me.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. So we turn very much outside ourselves for resources and for affirmation, because the inner self is really put on the back burner. Well, Jung was probably the first psychologist to really formalize this idea, and he called the inner self the wonder child. And Bradshaw, you've all heard of Bradshaw? He has his new book out called Homecoming, and it's all about the wonder child, how to recover this inner child. And what Jung meant, and what Winnicott meant, and many other people who picked up this idea, was that in your created self was this potentiality that you got genetically from God, that was put in you, and that as you would grow and develop, that all of the true things about you were there and could come out in terms of interests, sociability, special skills, and talents. And that what Jung said, and what Bradshaw is re-saying in such nice, clear ways, is that very early on, we began to adapt and deny our inner child who might be angry in favor of an adaptive response, because if I'm angry at someone that Dad wants me to make a good impression on so that that'll be good for his career, I have to adapt and learn to push that off. And what happens in the adaptation, I'm just going to draw a circle for ourselves now. When we adapt, we begin to push these parts of ourselves out here, and they don't exist anymore. And that's the real danger of all of this, is that as we begin to adapt, we take things like anger, our own needs, because I'm so busy pleasing other people, I never think that I might want an apple or an orange, or I might want to go to the front of the line. So we push that off to the side, and we deny it. Now, it doesn't die. It just hurts. And so what happens here, and this is why men do lots of denial, and we had a session where we talked about the one permissible emotion for men in our culture is anger. So men over here have anger. They may have a great deal of grief they were told to repress. And when a man decides to let his emotions out, he may just erupt. So this becomes fuel that we can't see. That's always intruding in our lives, messing things up. But we've cut it off and we've pushed it over here. Now, how much adaptation did you and I do? It depends upon how much pressure or abuse you experienced as a child. So someone who just experienced some pressure to meet others' needs would adapt to some degree. Someone who experienced abuse, physically, emotionally, or sexually, and I think it goes in that order of severity, because when we talk about a person, you can think of abuse as being more damaging as it gets closer to your body. So emotional abuse is very bad. You know, you dumb, stupid kid, you can't ever do it right. Physical abuse, you know, the Vince Lombardi school of raising children, hit him and hit him again. That is also damaging. And sexual abuse is the most damaging. And we know that sexual abuse is more damaging the earlier it starts and the more prolonged the period. And what happens then, the more abused we are, the more we find ourselves with having most of ourselves cut off and just a little bit of ourself available. And that's the process of how our wonder child becomes an adaptive child, and to some degree that's probably happened to most of us. I wouldn't say it's happened to all of us. Bradshaw would say it's happened to 90% of Americans. It's important. There's a little comment on the other sheet you have under point two, and I think this is worth looking at just for a minute. More adaptive pressure is probably placed on children by economically successful parents than by the less successful. This does not imply that these children will not be successful, that they will, however, be vulnerable to an inner sense of loss and depression. And so what you find in upper middle class communities is tremendous amount of pressure on children to succeed, to get it right, to be good at sports. It's not uncommon for us to see kids who are going to two and three sets of lessons, you know, ballet, tennis, softball pitching, year round in the third grade. Now I know that, I mean, softball pitching, but yes, they really do that. I had no idea. And little kids doing this. And what are they doing? They're probably living out, through the pressure of their parents' own insecurity and need to achieve. And what happens is that this adaptive child syndrome just repeats itself on over and over, because if I've been hurt as a child and haven't dealt with that and I'm not a complete self, one of the best ways to fix that is to make a perfect family, make a perfect church, or to make perfect kids. And in that, we then have the idea that we will receive healing. And I teach in two seminaries once in a while in Portland, and one of the current notions is that some seminarians go into the ministry to create a church family where they can receive nurturing and healing. And I think there's some validity to that. So this is the process we're talking about, where we start this way, where we adapt, and where we stop now and say, you know, I need to recover from this. Let's stop and take a few moments of questions or comments about this process, if you have any. Any questions or illustrations or comments? Make sense? Okay. Well, what does this child thrive on? This child thrives on unconditional love. Unconditional love. And you see, unconditional love is something we can't pass on until we've got it for ourselves, because until we're comfortable in ourselves, we're always trying to get other people to adapt to our comfort zones. And that's why, it takes a healthy parent to let a child throw a temper tantrum in the church aisle. A healthy parent, you see, because unless you're comfortable with your own self, then you aren't comfortable with your child acting out and maybe learning what they need to, like screaming and beating their head on the carpet isn't going to work. And the sooner a child learns that at their own hand, the better. But what happens is, if we're insecure, we run and pick up the child and stop their learning process. And so we have to have our own self pretty secure before we can pass this on.
Can I make a comment or ask
please,
a question?
Sure.
I have a real problem with that, because if you're letting your child scream in the aisle, that may be healthy for you and healthy for the child, but that's disrupting the opportunity for other people to worship.
Okay, lousy illustration. I didn't tell you church was over and everybody was
No, but what she's saying is response. You can say that in any aspect. There is really a confusing balance between, I mean, living in a social environment, if we were all by ourselves somewhere, it might be entirely different. But don't we have a responsibility as a parent to at least teach our children kinds of social behavior that are acceptable and some that aren't?
Oh, I think so. And what I'm thinking about, a grocery store is a lot better illustration, where if you don't want the soap, go to another store, just wait to go down the aisle till the kid's done. But there's some time, and I'm thinking early on now, like, 12, 13, 14 months, that the sooner children learn that certain behaviors don't work, the better it is. But it takes a secure parent to let a child cry it out. Let me just give you another example. I've recently been working with a mother who's nursing a 2-year-old boy who can't let the boy cry it out. And this lady just can't nurse anymore. She's exhausted. She's sick. She's getting up 3 times a night. And her physician and I say, please stop nursing your child. She says, well, when he cries, it terrifies me. And I've assured her that this child will probably cry most of the night and cry until he loses his voice. I met the boy. I'm sure he's got the energy to cry till he loses. But you see, she won't be able to do that until she's really sure that it's not her that's defective, that he's doing his work of growing and being, and that's a form of unconditional love. It happens later on when kids want to make choices to go into music or not go into it, or not go into the sport that mom or dad have dreamed of them going into, or whatever. I have a good friend who just joined a tennis club so his boy could become a tennis player. You know what the kid did? He went out for football. What was he doing? In part, this boy was saying, I'm going to be my own person. I need to pick something that's for me. This dad did a wonderful thing. He kept the membership at the tennis club. He went and played tennis. That's what he should have done. He should have enrolled himself in the tennis club to begin with, because it was his idea. And he let his boy become an aspiring football player. But he could only do that out of his complete self. So that's what we're talking about as we pass it on. Clearly, kids need to learn social behaviors. And I think they learn it better quicker and more effectively from parents who are comfortable with who they are rather than trying to make everybody happy. And so if we grow up in a home where anger isn't allowed, we get over-socialized and we lose our inner self. If we grow up with no rules, we don't learn who we are and we don't learn skills. And we're going to talk later this week about skills. You see, two aspects of self-esteem are unconditional love. The second is skills. We're not talking at all today about skills. And that's where the discussion of self-esteem sometimes gets stuck, because we try to make it one or the other. It isn't. The two sides of the coin of self-esteem, on the one side are this wonderful sense that I am really a special person worth celebrating. I have a lot of trouble with that, because those are new ideas for me. You know, I grew up in a good German home where we learned a lot of rules, but we never touched each other. And, you know, that's just the way it is. The other side of self-esteem is not just feeling wonderful about who you are, it's having a skill. Because if we don't have a skill in this world, we can't fit into community as being a contributor. Now, what Americans do in success-oriented families is we give skills, but we don't give the sense of being wonderful, so we create reinforcement addicts. And we're doing great as long as we're getting pats and strokes and winning. But when we come to a negative experience, we don't have anything to fall back on. So the inner child is probably the platform of self-esteem with skills built on top of it. But you can't have a person with self-esteem who doesn't have both sides of that coin. Because if they just feel wonderful and go out in the world with no skills, they land on their rear. On the other hand, if they don't feel wonderful about who they are, when they get out in the world, they work till they drop. And that's what many, many of us have done.
What kind of skills do you mean? Do you mean social skills or do you mean carpentry?
I mean social skills, carpentry, welding, reading, math, how to ride mass transit. You know, what being able to manage the world, having utilitarian skills. Because if you just feel good about yourself and don't have skills at a very early age, you fall back into despair as well.
Can I say something?
Mm-hmm.
If you grow up in a household where you're accepted and loved unconditionally, I don't think there's any way that you can do that and feel good about yourself and not develop skills, because part of the unconditional love is allowing the child to fail and to develop the skills, which you talked about.
I think that's a good observation. One flows from the other. Mm-hmm. When we talk about unconditional love and dysfunctional families, there's a passage in Philippians that describes Jesus as coming to encompass our reality. And I want to just read just a couple verses of that. Who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in the appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on the cross. Who was Jesus interested in, himself or the other? The other. What is an abusive parent interested in? Himself or the other? Interested in himself. And I think a nice way to say it is that true love encompasses the reality of the other person, particularly when we're parenting. And dysfunctional love encompasses the other person with our needs. So, and I was a pastor for a while, and I can remember those feelings, and I know what it's like now when I take my kids to the hospital. I really hate it when they whine, moan, throw a fit, defy me in front of other people. That's very irritating. But the question is this: am I able to encompass my child's needs, or am I going to force my child to adapt to my needs? Now, if the child needs discipline, discipline is in order. I'm not against discipline, by the way. But if this is an exhausted child and we've just gotten back from 6 hours driving home from Holden and we stop by the hospital, which we will, and our children are incorrigible, which they will be, when I tell them, you know, don't you cry when we walk in here, just sit at the nurse's station and color, what am I doing? I'm putting my needs on the child and asking them to deny a reality that's really going on in them. And we do it in subtle ways. But you see, the real sad news is that half of the women in America have been abused physically and sexually, probably. And that's really putting your need on somebody, isn't it? I mean, that's really saying to this person, you don't matter much. I matter a lot. You adapt to what I need. Don't cry. Don't tell. Don't complain. Just go on with your life like nothing happened. And we know that's happening to boys as well as to girls. So we want to think about it in the lighter forms of parents forcing achievement on children and the more severe forms of parents actually forcing their needs on children. But when we talk about children, remember, we're talking about ourselves. Because whatever happened to us at that level stays in us as an energizing force until we do something with this part of ourselves that adapted and learned to be polite. Anybody want to share an example of how you have adapted or learned to cut off certain emotions or feelings? One lady shared cutting off anger. Anybody want to talk about this a bit more before we go on?
Well, I can think of cutting off grief. I was thinking of it this morning when my father died and I was 9. It was, they just told me he died and I wasn't allowed to go to the funeral. I think that's just the way it was at that time. You didn't know what to do with the kid. It was kind of the way society was.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really thought about it. After that. I didn't know the impact it would have on my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I cut off grieving or being hurt or having, I was moving then after that to a different city and it was hard to leave my friends and everybody in our family just tucked it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was miserable and I let everybody know and they didn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I expressed that everybody was feeling, but they didn't
want to
hear it.
Right. Yeah, that's a good example of how she's been required to push the grief away and adapt with another response. Mm-hmm.
This may sound trite in comparison to that, but it's had a big impact on my life. Mm-hmm. My father was chronically late.
Mm-hmm.
and I mean, daily in everything he did. And he lived a good distance from the school, but he always walked because it was faster than waiting for my father to get her out. But if it were really raining hard or snowing hard or a little bear or something, we really didn't have any choice. And we were forced to quietly wait while he sipped his coffee or had another piece of toast or whatever. And I felt that I was always forced to repress the embarrassment that I felt at walking into school late, and I was given no support from my mother, either from just the little mouse in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And it's made me obsessively punctual.
Yeah. Now, that's a wonderful illustration. Take just a moment to look at something that I want to make sure you don't get trapped in but can use effectively. Have any of you read the book Happiness is a Choice? Okay, there's lots of books like that, and really what they imply is that if we think right, we'll feel right. And there's a lot of truth to that. There really is. I mean, there's enormous truth to the fact that if we will think realistically, we'll feel better. For instance, if I have the sense that I have to walk in a room during a church social and everyone has to smile at me before I'll feel okay, I'm going to walk out feeling miserable, probably. So if I can learn to think right, that if I can walk into this room and talk with three people, that'll be a successful social event, and then I can leave feeling good. That's how thinking. Within us. And you know, you said that might sound like a trite illustration, but I don't think it sounds trite to this room. I think we can feel what it's like to not be important, to not be special, to not have our life celebrated by our dad. I think most of us can get a sense of that. Well, that creates a wound in us, and all the right thinking up here won't fix that. And so what we do sometimes is we use an excellent psychology tool, which is right thinking, on the wrong problem, which is a childhood wound. You see, you can't just think this away. This is a wound. This is real. It isn't irrational. It can't be rethought of in a better way. And that's why many people, and I know you have this experience working with folks who say, I just can't feel God's love. And you tell them, well, God died for you, he loves you, he loves you unconditionally, and they say, I know it, and I know it's true for you, but it's not true for me, because my wound, and this is what they don't know how to say, my wound is in the way of letting me feel like God would be on time for me. And so we have to deal with the wound and not just give right-thinking speeches to people. And that's a, you know, these are nice examples of wounds, of not going to a funeral, of not being important enough that somebody could get there in the cold for you. Anybody else want to share one before we go along? Or any questions about this?
Question. Okay. You have this wound. You say right thinking is not going to take care of it. What is the process or the procedure then that would take care of it? Because I think just saying, I'm screwed up because I had a terrible childhood doesn't really help you today.
No,
you can live on that sadness and be destroyed the rest of your life, or you can stop at a point, look at it, and go on. But what is the go-on process that...
Well, I put two things over here under recovery. One is new learning, trial and error, letting ourselves try new things to begin to discover what we like anyway. And the other aspect is an internal discovery, not just going out there and trying new careers or interest areas or activities, but really slowing down and beginning to discover my own inner feeling world. And that's where Bradshaw says that the healing is in the grieving. Not that you get stuck in the grieving, but that if we have a wound, the healing of that wound starts in the grieving, but as the grieving process goes along, we recover lots of other emotions that were cut off as well. And whatever that wound is, as we grieve it, we begin a journey of internal discovery. And so what would be the two predominant features if you went to a recovery weekend? Any recovery, an AA recovery weekend, a sexual abuse recovery weekend, there would be two predominant features. One would be new social playtimes. So it's a real common thing for recovery groups for people our age to have a 50s ice cream social. They'll have a dance and a sock hop, something like that, and they'll serve ice cream instead of an addictive substance of some sort. I know but it's nothing compared to alcohol, cocaine. You know, it's okay. If you can convert to ice cream, please. You know.
We just keep the chocolate topping in the middle.
Right. That would be one of the predominant experiences, would be to get together and play and relax and just begin to meet each other at that level. The second thing would be times of quiet, where a leader would just simply have you rethink and re-experience some of your past hurts. not because there's anything magic about walking back through a minefield of pain, but because if you can go back to that minefield of pain with the attitude that I'm going to grieve it and get through it, there's things there to discover and move past. So those would be, in terms of recovery, the two things that you'd want to look at. New learning out here and a new respect. And that would start with the grieving of the wound instead of saying, now look, just talk yourself out of it and go on.
How important is it for men to be able to cry?
I don't think it's important for anybody to be able to do anything on anybody's timetable. I think it's important for each one of us to decide how much of our emotional self we want to recover, what the costs are, and where we're at in our own life. I really, really think that the courage to change our own life has to always be left in the hands of the person doing the changing. It can't be imposed by a norm, a counselor, an author, an expert, a preacher. I have to set my own agenda. Crying is a part of human existence. But it may be for someone who was hurt in a certain way that to recover that may cost more than they're prepared for at this time in their life. And let me just give you a little aside about that. If some of you, and I know you are, working in counseling and peer counseling relationships, someone might say, I don't have any memory past a certain age, and I know my sister was hurt, I wonder what happened to me. And you might say to them with all kinds of energy, well, you know, you should recover that and you'll be better for it. Not at all. That's a journey that only that person can set their sails for. Because sometimes these journeys into grieving take 2 and 3 years. And as a church and as lay friends, we've often got the energy for about 3 to 6 months. And then we start telling people. And this is one of the real places where the church needs to stretch in its response to hurt people, is that people hurt severely in childhood. You know, the rule of thumb is 3 to 5 years. If you've been seriously hurt, sexually abused, or damaged dramatically. But we have trouble giving folks that much time. And so it has to be up to the individual. Excellent question. Other comments along those lines? Let me turn then to number 3 on the poor rich child outline, which follows on, how do we do recovery? Because, you know, this needs to be a fairly specific response. If we don't know how to do recovery, maybe we've learned how to define another problem and don't know what to do about it, and that's not very comforting. You know, just to put a new name on it doesn't give us a lot. So one of my friends that I work with has a really nice way of talking about recovery. This is an outline that would be for a recovery workshop, new trial and error learning and some internal discovery. He would say, and I like his way of saying it, that recovery is about being an adolescent. And so I've given you the stages of adolescent development. You see, an adolescent is in the business of getting their inner wonder child connected for the journey of adult life. And we say that adolescents start the business of adolescence by not knowing who they are. And that's a precondition, that's a necessary condition of the adolescent work, is to not know who I am. Now, there's a danger, and that is that the adolescent work can get skipped by foreclosure or adaptation, you see. Because this is the same idea. This is, you can do foreclosure in a lot of ways. But foreclosure is where instead of doing the work to struggle and figure out who I am, I look around and pick out somebody else's identity and make it mine. Can you give me illustrations of that that's happened in you or other people? So the group will have a feel for that.
Don't all teenagers look and walk and talk exactly like everyone else in an attempt to be totally different? I mean, each teenager?
Not all of them, but if you want to give us any... Exactly.
I mean, you know, the way they comb their hair, the way the clothes they choose, that all tend to be looking at somebody else.
And so that would be an example of adapting to their own peer group.
Okay.
That happens.
I have a 14-year-old son who I can't decide whether or not to be worried about or not, but this just puts a name to what I've seen happening with him. He's very, very bright, physically quite talented, suddenly developed a friendship with a boy who felt that school was not important and that in sports, if you're not winning, you quit. And who has adopted, I don't know what they call it today, but a few years ago they called it a punk appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm seeing my son becoming his clone, and he doesn't understand why I don't approve of this friend. It's very, very frightening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in this period, as we get from not knowing who we are to knowing who we are, we go through a danger zone. Now, there's some folks in the village who are very expert on Stephen Glenn's resources for raising adolescents, and he would say in his research that what correlates with getting from here to here safely is having two or three close relationships with non-peers. Because the one thing that we see happen in our culture is we lose kids to their peer group because we've educated them in a peer group philosophy, and the peers know nothing about how to get from here to here. So if you're raising smaller kids, the goal would be to get them connected in friendship to older cousins, aunts and uncles, and so on. Foreclosure is specifically not just the adoption of a peer group philosophy, but another parent. It could even be the family value, but it's adapting to somebody else's values without thinking it through. Anybody teach in college? One seminary professor in the room. Do you see young seminarians come with a theology that they've picked up from somebody else but isn't theirs?
Unfortunately, yes.
And then they go through their educational process of sometimes giving that up and creating their own theology. And the people that they were alive with before they went to seminary were happy, and then after they get to seminary and get their own theology, they're sad. The seminary ruined our kids.
Yeah.
I hear that in our community. Our community 20 years ago created a special seminary that would only teach this point of view, so that the 21-year-old men and women who went there would not go through this process, but would stay in this. This is a difficult process. Oh, go ahead.
Just in terms of the most interesting and most difficult thing when that happens is that when the theology that the seminary student has or has adapted is that of his or her spouse.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all sorts of difficulties in that relationship. And it's always a tremendously difficult thing about, you know, one is learning all sorts of very new and sometimes very threatening things at the seminary, whereas back home, right, the spouse is still this, and now how do you bring those two together, or how do you go through that struggle together now as a couple or as a family? That becomes tremendously difficult for the seminarians and the family.
Oh, absolutely, because if we go back to our model of adaptation, and I cut off some part of myself because it's threatening, and now I grow, and I bring this part, say grief, or anger, or a new point of view in, but I married a man or a woman who matched me in terms of adaptation. I mean, neither of us liked anger, so we got together. And now you went to therapy and do anger, or you went to seminary and have a different point of view, See, now it's not that you threaten me at a head level, although we'll argue about it like it's a head level. We're really affecting each other at deep emotional levels, and it's like, you know, streams of different currents running together. Now, we'll argue about it like it's truth, but it's really about feeling. So what is Holden about? Well, isn't Holden about struggle and self-creation? It's not about foreclosure. It's about letting us do the work of our own adolescence, beginning to take a time out and to think and feel for myself. And that's another way of talking about recovery, is being able to have my own feelings and thoughts.
I think another example of foreclosure is for young men who were in their late teens or early 20s during the Vietnam era, where society imposed the foreclosure by saying, these are the safe paths you can take if you don't want to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would choose graduate school or seminary or medical school or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Right, and the individual there didn't have to struggle with and come to their own point of view because they took predefined avenues and could make that their temporary self. Would that be an accurate way to finish that?
Mm-hmm. I had just kind of had some insight as you were talking about foreclosure, and I think I experienced that, or we experienced that in my family of seven children, whereas I was the second oldest of the seven and one who, for whatever reasons, my place in the family was willing to take risks and did things first. And I have found that my younger siblings, sisters especially, have said to me that they've tried to model and copy and do everything just like I,
mm-hmm.
just like their big sister,
mm-hmm.
and in even making choices in partners and things, and then found that they weren't happy and had to struggle as adult children with letting go of some of that patterning that they tried to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that happens in other families.
Oh, absolutely. Kids pattern after each other, and we pick up these roles. You see, if mom and dad don't do the roles and they impose their needs on us, we're going to pick up the roles. We're going to be heroes or surrogate parents or distractors or whatever. And when we pick up that role, when we're somewhere between, you know, 1 and 18, we're not doing our own business of adolescence, are we? We're doing family adaptation stuff.
Another example of foreclosure is when young women are sexually abused, or children are sexually abused, and they learn that in order to get love, I have to give sex.
Mm-hmm.
And so they develop a pattern of being sexual in order to try to get the love that they need so badly from a lot of times the person who abused them,
mm-hmm.
who couldn't give it to them.
Right. And go ahead.
When I'm looking at this, would this have anything to do with many of these 12-step programs that are going on now?
Yeah, and if you look on the back of What is an Adult Child, we photocopied for you Bradshaw's strategy of how you come out of being an adaptive child to a healthy person. And let's see, it's the third box from the bottom, new awareness, cognitive life raft, feeling, and 12-step meetings. And the 12-step meetings is a place that we can go and essentially learn from other people who've been hurt. And we talked about that in an earlier group as a nice model. Having guides who have been wounded instead of people telling you how to do things that were easy for them but hard for you. And historically we've done a lot of that. We've had the guides be people who learn to read easy, and we find that it works a little better if the guides are people who've had some of the same pain. And so 12-stepping just has taken the country by storm because it works. And if you know the politics of it, it's very fascinating, because the professional mental health community tried to divorce itself from and replace the 12-step model several years ago and just used traditional techniques. But the 12-step recovery movement was so successful, we've adopted it. It survived in spite of professionals trying to stop it. It's a wonderful movement. It has its flaws, but...
Is the use of drugs a foreclosure in a way?
No, the use of drugs would be an adaptive response. I shouldn't use that word since we're using it. It would be a coping response to dealing with the wound. And that's why Bradshaw, who is certainly at the forefront of the drug addiction recovery work, would say that you've got to grieve instead of drink or take or use. And so the use of drugs many times is not this simplistic model of somebody who liked to get high who then used, but it's a coping response for this chronic, just inside gut feeling of I'm never okay. And you know, that can live in the most successful looking person you've ever seen, or it can live in the girl who lives on the street. And there's more girls who live on the street than boys because more girls have been sexually abused. But it's a response to this depression, this wound inside. Now, the title of our topic is about how most of us in this room cope with our wounds. We cope by obsessively pleasing, by continuing the adaptation, by making sure that everybody likes me, by saying yes all the time. And other people will cope in other ways. There was another hand that I...
Well, I was just going to ask a question. I'm not as familiar as I should be with the 12-step program, so this may be obvious to other people, but is confronting the person who wounded you, is that important or is that not important?
Certainly complex. So I'd be glad to take different responses from folks in the room if you want to respond.
I'd like to speak to that. In 12-stepping, the total emphasis is on self. And so if we've been wounded by a parent, for instance, my father is an alcoholic who's never recovered, still drinks. I was sexually abused from age 4 by different boys to by age 12. And I had just a vast amount of anger inside toward these different parties that abused me. And until I started the 12-step emphasis and looked at myself, because so often other ways of dealing with your past are, you know, get in touch with that anger toward this person and write them a letter or confront them somehow. That doesn't get to it. It hasn't gotten to it for me. But to get to it is look at myself and what I'm doing and what I've done because of these things happening to me, and then fix it. And so it's a totally selfish, self-focused way of recovering, and I think that's why it works so well, is a pattern for addicts is to blame the other parties and then soothe your own dysfunction with drugs or resentment, or it can manifest itself overeating. It can manifest itself so many different ways. So it's totally a self-focused emphasis as opposed to other people.
But it's not a me-ism in the sense of taking. It's a very responsible self-focus, which completes myself so that I have the riches to give to other people, just as you sharing with us is giving us riches from your work. So it's not a grabbing kind of a self-focus, but it's an awareness that I've got, you know, this is my wonder child in here, and nobody else is probably going to come along and take care of it. So I guess I better start doing that.
So it's that celebration of self that it had originally.
we all lose it to some degree, and that's no fault of our parents. And clearly I want you to understand, just as you said, this isn't about blaming our backgrounds, no matter how bad they are. It's about my responsibility for taking care of the gifts that were given to me.
One other comment. As Christians, I think we're taught to, it's better to give than receive. And I think a lot of us take that too far, to the point we can't give anymore and then feel guilty about it, completely ignoring our own needs. I don't remember my parents ever, I think that's something I've sort of adopted. And Christians, that's one other form of this type of thing, ignoring our own needs.
Right, and that's where we started with, by being taught in a Christian home that my feeling of anger and whatever needs were around that should be pushed down in favor of the rule of pleasing others. And it's not about changing Jesus' words. I like to say, I can love the way I was taught to love. And the more I know how to love myself, the more I can love other people. That's right. Comment in the back.
I like what you say, but I have a disquieting thought in all this, too. You know, you started by saying that, you know, this is the latest thing, and it's really very popular.
Well, the room.
And I have heard, the room is full. And I've heard the criticism, you know, saying this is the newest religion, what you're talking about in this type of thing. And it is the topic of Unitarian churches. This is the stuff they preach.
You're right.
And I'm wondering, where does the gospel fit in? How do we, you know, the fact that I can rearrange all the furniture inside here, looking for this precious child and all of that, but that's not where you're going to find the meaning and purpose of all of life. It's in Christ, from outside. The dealing with confession as to who I am. This is a sinful world. So I'd like your response to that, because there is a disquieting thing within me, as much as I like what I hear.
Oh, no, I don't disagree with what you're saying at all, and that's why we run a recovery group in a hospital that has pastors in worship as a part of it. Our pastoral counselors and our psychiatric program have as much influence and power as the psychiatrists and psychologists because of that dimension. I think the way it is Christian is that from the Philippians passage, we get a sense that God gives unconditional love to us and meets us on our ground. And that one of the wounds that has come to American kids is that they never experienced life on God's terms, but rather they were used. They were abused for their parents' neurotic needs. And that it happens in middle-class, well-to-do communities just as much as in any other community, and sexual abuse crosses those boundaries. And when you have this wound in here, that the gospel itself does not automatically come down and create a healing there. Now, let me tell you why I believe that. And it might be interesting for you to know that I was a pastor for 7 years and consult to charismatic churches in the most conservative part of American Christianity, not just the more mainstream part. And they believe absolutely that going to the altar and receiving Christ will heal this wound. I literally don't see it happen any more often than I see people get healed of broken arms or diabetes or high blood pressure by the gospel. Because I believe that this wound is contained now in the organ of your brain. And I would give a whole lecture on the fact that your brain is an organ. It has a billion nerve cells that in your cerebral cortex have memorized, contained, and held this wound. And that we have to reaccess and heal this wound at a real level, just as we treat heart disease or diabetes. Now, the healing in psychology and life history doesn't always come from medicine. But I would even throw in for a moment that if you've suffered depression, we're going to talk about depression Friday, for 10 or 15 years because of a childhood wound, your brain chemistry now may even be in need of a little help. And sometimes we see people needing antidepressant medicine or anti-anxiety medicine and relearning experiences as a part of the healing process. Not in any way to say that now we've got this person healed, therefore they have meaning in their life. No, that it's only at this level now this person is ready to be a Christian. In the sense of, I have struggled through and made my choice in terms of a value system and identity. So I don't know if I'm doing it, but I would want to be very compatible and cooperative to what you're saying, only adding in some healing theory and belief.
How do you then talk in terms of the fact that Christ gives me my identity? I mean, so that comes on the top, not at the tail end.
Well, and there's a tension that I can't resolve for you, because I utterly believe that it comes from him to me, and in a funny way, he told me to choose him and be a follower. And, you know, that's a theological discussion that I'm not qualified to do the technicalities of. But I don't disagree with you. He comes to me out of grace, but somehow I have to follow him out of myself. And the more damaged the self, the more...